Hello, thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit biteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my special guest is Michael P. Masters. He is the author of Identified Flying Objects, a multidisciplinary scientific approach to the UFO phenomenon. Could UFOs and aliens simply be us, but from the future? This provocative new book cautiously examines the premise that extraterrestrials may instead be our distant human descendants, using the anthropological tool of time travel to visit and study us in their own hominin evolutionary past. Dr. Michael P. Masters, a professor of biological anthropology, specializing in human evolutionary anatomy, archaeology, and biomedicine, explores how the persistence of long-term biological and cultural trends in human evolution may ultimately result in us becoming the ones piloting these disc-shaped crafts, which are very likely the devices that allow our future progeny to venture backwards across the landscape of time. For more information, you can visit his website, which is idflyobj.com. That's idflyobj.com. So that, I'd like to welcome Mike to the show. Good day, Mike.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
I'm doing well, thank you. I'm really looking forward to today's show. This the study that you did is just a perspective I have never heard before, and I just think it's fascinating. So I'd like to start with, I understand that your interest in flying objects, whether they be identified or not, might have been influenced when, as a child, you learned about an experience your father had with a UFO. Would you mind sharing with us about that?
Yeah, sure. I was about 8 years old, and I was creeping down the stairs after I was supposed to be in bed because some friends were over, some friends of my parents, and as every inquisitive little child does, they always want to know what's going on. And I overheard a story about an encounter that my father had. He was a veterinarian, and I grew up in Northeast Ohio in a very rural part of the state, and specifically in Amish country where a lot of Amish people live. And it's very dark there, and he and a colleague were out on a farm call one night, and they spotted this bright glowing orb across the horizon. And as he described it, it sat there for a little bit, and they stopped at the top of this hillside because they were obviously curious about what that was. And all of a sudden, it darted toward their truck and just sat there about 100 meters from the truck and was a very large craft. He described it as kind of a glowing orb that didn't really emit light rays in the way that a street light would or something like that. But it sat there for a little bit, jetted back across the horizon, and then shot straight up at a very fast speed into the sky and disappeared from sight.
Now, would you say that that might have been the start of your interest in the flying objects?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It was really the first time I'd ever even heard of this phenomenon. I'd never come across anything up to that point. So I asked the next day, you know, what this story was, and they just kind of shrugged it off, like, oh, nothing. I did ask him about it later in college once I really started to develop a deeper interest in this and just got a little more detail about it and took notes and wrote it down because I thought it was still interesting, especially having been the origins. But what really got me interested in it from a biological standpoint was after he got the book Communion by Whitley Strieber, and I looked up and saw that book on the shelf in our living room and kind of had this flash of awareness or this image that entered my head of an early hominin, or at the time what I kind of imagined was a chimpanzee-like cranium and face, In the middle was a human form, modern human, and then on the right side was this quintessential alien form, like what exists on the cover of that book. So I sort of sensed that there may be a relationship, or at least wanted to investigate it further. So set on a path to do that over the next 30 plus years.
Wow. So do you feel that, the idea of, since there was, that biological aspect, that what is that quintessential alien form that people talk about is the evolution of humans to that point?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where it initially came from because, I mean, even just thinking about the most commonly described alien form as being big-headed, big-eyed, small nose, small mouth, tiny ears, relative hairlessness, and most importantly, being upright walking, or what we call bipedalism in anthropology, which is actually the trait that defines our lineage. Walking upright on two legs is very rare among all mammals, and we are actually the only primate out of all of our closely related relatives in the primate order. We're the only one that habitually walks upright on two legs. So the fact that these beings are described as being upright walking humanoids initially indicated that there is probably some sort of connection. But digging deeper and looking at the specifics of our especially our craniofacial anatomy and what major changes have taken place over the last 6 to 8 million years since we diverged with what would eventually become the chimpanzees, we have just a tremendous number of traits that we share in common with these reported beings, what we refer to as homologies or synapomorphies specifically. So, just looking more deeply at those and doing my dissertation was on hominin craniofacial evolution, how our skulls and faces change in response to various biological and also cultural things that we've done, things like using stone tools, cutting meat, cooking things over a fire, and softening the foods that we eat. And all of these things helped relax selective pressure for a larger face. So our faces have been shrinking. Our crania have not only been getting larger, our neurocranium, our brain specifically, but also expanding laterally. And that's one of the traits that defines anatomically modern humans is that we have what's known as a bulbous neurocranium. It's a big globular round cranium. And that's, again, a very quintessential characteristic of this archetypal alien form.
Yeah. I'm just curious, there have been, that form, found, through archaeology. So do you think that there's a possibility that this travel could have even gone back? Well, obviously, if they're developed to that point, we're talking about quite a long period in our future for that type of transition to happen.
Well, partly, perhaps, that's possible. The thing to keep in mind, though, is that this transition has been accelerating. So if you plot our relative cranial size and just these changes in the craniofacial anatomy, it's very much a geometric curve. It's an accelerating rate of change. And I try not to speculate about what types of things in the future may contribute to these changes because we can't know that, and I really try to avoid speculation in this research, but rather just looking at this pattern of continuous and accelerating change in these same traits over hominin evolutionary time, and especially since the domestication of plants and animals, agriculture, beginning 10,000 years ago, you can see it really spike up in shape changes in particular. So if those continued forward and continued to accelerate, it might not actually be that long. And something a lot of people mentioned too, which I think is a valid point, is we already have the technology for like CRISPR technology, modifying our genes. And it's possible that we could get to the point where we do that and we accelerate it farther because of the cultural things that we have, the technologies that we have, which have always been, or at least in the last 3 million years or so, have been part of that accelerating change.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I could see where that might may not be that far in the future. So obviously with the idea of this may be our, you know, many descendants coming back. So then that obviously had to introduce the time travel, correct? So that when that all kind of came into, I mean, making sense as to how we could see them in the present?
Yeah, and throughout the past. Like you mentioned, there's a lot of indications of the same sort of craniofacial form throughout our prehistoric past. I just saw an article the other day about one of the earliest instances of intentional cranial modification, which I think if I remember correctly, took place in China about 12,000 years ago. So, and these aren't, it's important to point out that these aren't future humans, or probably they're not even hybrids between a future human group and a past human group, but rather just the influence and individuals attempting to recreate that cranial facial form by binding the skulls of their infants, which helps to create that same sort of elongated skull and bigger forehead, which they might have associated with these, what I refer to as extratempestrials, these individuals from our distant human future.
Wow. Yeah, that makes sense. So, the one thing I like about your book is it's a scientific approach, and you very methodically go through your explanations and the fact that it's also multidisciplinary. So would you mind sharing with us, and I know that you, in the process of bringing the manuscript into publication, that you also had, you know, peer review of it. So I'm really interested to find out the disciplines that were involved in that and how they would kind of fit into the picture.
Yeah, so from an early point in this research, I realized that there's no way to really fully understand this from just a biological standpoint. I started out in physics and astronomy because I was very keen on investigating the time aspects of it, and namely time travel, and physics is one of the best places to do that. But then I switched about halfway through my undergraduate career at Ohio University in Southern Ohio, and switched into anthropology because I felt that looking at the biological side is something that hadn't really been done, and it just kind of interested me more. A lot of people have looked at these craft and their physical form and potential capabilities and things like that, but there hadn't really been a lot of discussion of what specific elements of our hominin past on the morphological changes may be associated with linking together this form through time. So I switched into that, but still maintained a very close eye on research in physics, and especially with regard to the physics of time and time travel. But then outside of those two fields, you can't talk about this phenomenon without also talking about the extraterrestrial hypothesis, this idea that a humanoid form somehow developed on another planet in a different solar system with different gravity and different chemical characteristics and climate and just general environmental traits, which falls into the realm of astrobiology. What is the likelihood that this would happen again? And then the astronomy is obviously a big part of that too. What's the chance that they would be able to find us based on limitations in communication, electromagnetic signals, radio signals that we send out specifically, being able to find us in the vastness of space, to travel across the cosmos, to visit us. So really I felt like it needed at least those four fields, and you could argue that there's far more disciplines within the sciences that could be instrumental in helping us answer this question. Psychology would be a huge one, especially if we are to have disclosure and full-on contact. What's the psyche of people now having to wrap their heads around something so complex and so distant into the future and so different from what we conceptualize on a daily basis? The effect on the economy is an important one. I think economics would have a role to play here, sociology as well. So I think there's still a lot of room to expand this research into other fields, but I felt to write this book and to do so in a relatively holistic way, it would require at least anthropology, astronomy, physics, and astrobiology. So that's why I really focused on those four disciplines in doing this research.
Great. So now you indicated that that's a scientific approach. So, you know, with the study of, the extraterrestrials or the idea of UFOs in that particular realm, is it difficult to find or conduct scientific study to be able to, with the scientific process, sometimes it's difficult, to prove something that might be esoteric. So is it difficult to find studies or to even conduct studies scientifically?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And with my research specifically, yeah, there's that issue of, well, is this a real phenomenon? Are these reports something that we can use as evidence? And I use it as circumstantial evidence in the book until we have disclosure, and we are starting to get that. The government, the military, Congress has been briefed on this phenomenon. They've come out and said, yes, we're taking this seriously. This is a real thing. But it's still going to take much more knowledge of this relationship in the present and across this bridge between the future and past before we can really consider that as evidence. And I treat it very cautiously in the book. With that said, what's important about this research and the method, it falls in the category of abductive reasoning. And it took me a while talking about this before I realized that people could confuse abductive reasoning with abductions. But it's really just I know I need to be careful of that. I didn't used to define it, and then someone pointed that out. I realized that's something I should probably mention. But it's just a form of logical inference that tries to come up with the most plausible conclusion without having the ability to positively verify it. It's basically an inference to the best explanation, kind of an Occam's razor approach you can think of it as. So that's the method that was used in researching this book, is trying to draw evidence from these different fields based on real, tangible scientific studies, and then apply that in the context of the UFO phenomenon, coming up with the best possible explanation, and that seemed to point to time travel. And the last thing I'll mention about that is what's important about this and what distinguishes it from the extraterrestrial hypothesis is this extratempestrial model is innately testable. And that's a very important aspect of scientific studies, is that a hypothesis has to be testable and falsifiable. And this model is simply because it makes a prediction about a future state. And once we get to that point, we will know whether or not that's accurate. Even if we destroy ourselves in a nuclear holocaust or something and everybody dies, we've still innately tested that hypothesis. So that's another important distinction, I think, that gives it a little more scientific credibility compared to things just speculating about what may or may not be out in the universe somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. So now let's just talk a little bit about time and time travel. There's a belief that time is a human construct, and that the reality is that the past, present, and future are happening simultaneously. Some folks believe that. So.
Oh yeah, no, that's a very common belief. Absolutely, it's sort of the dominant model in the block universe landscape. Time is what it's known as.
Yeah. So, with that in mind, then does it? How does travel between something happening all at the same time? How does that? What's your view or perspective of keeping that in mind, travel would happen? I mean, how do you see that happening? Is it a physical movement?
Yeah, essentially, if you want to transport yourself and these big clunky metal craft out of your time and into a past time, it would be a physical transition. And yeah, I'm glad you brought up this idea of block time, because it is a very good model for understanding the universe. And the basics of it is that all moments that exist, obviously there is this thing of time. It's something that is the reason why things go from one state to another. We can see changes take place. And so clearly there is this dimension of time. But the way in which it works in the physical universe and the way in which we understand it as biological beings is somewhat different. So the idea in block time is that all moments that have ever existed and will ever exist, from the beginning of the universe, of the Big Bang, to the end of the universe, however it may end, exist as one giant entity. There's still change within that, but you can think of it as a big block of four-dimensional space-time. And our brains aren't really capable of imagining that. That's why when things are written out on paper in two dimensions, we always have to sacrifice one of those dimensions of space to animate time. But in looking at space-time that way, we can then understand how we as biological organisms who need to make sense of this change and to be able to interact with our environment have developed a perception of time that makes sense to us. It's biologically derived. We can understand that a past cause elicits a future effect, and we can see how moving from this place to that place happens in space and time. We move from this place to that place over a certain period of time. So to actually physically send yourself and these craft back through time, I talk about kind of the history of research that's taken place since Einstein's initial field equations associated with his theory of general relativity around 1915. And there's been a number of derivations of his field equations which have shown that it may be possible to construct what are known as closed time-like curves, in which you're able to visit the past because you reorient your future light cones toward the past. And what a light cone is, if you imagine shining a beam of light from a flashlight, just flick it on real fast, everything that can happen in the world around you as you move through that exists within the boundaries of that radiating cone of light, because nothing can go faster than the speed of light. So all of our reality exists within that cone. So what's interesting about it, and I inject a common mantra from biology that form follows function, you can look at the form of these craft, and based on the research that's been done with regard to how we would reorient those light cones toward the past, meaning everything that happens to us locally in our future is actually moving backward through time relative to everyone else in global block time. So we're changing our position going forward in time, but backwards. And that's an aspect of reorienting those light cones toward the past. And so I discussed the research going back as early as 1917, and consistently the same theme emerges, that you have a rapidly spinning cylinder or ring, or in many cases a disc, which, if you look at the most commonly described form of these craft, they are a rotating disc. And that form of the craft, in association with its function of flying, much like a frisbee does, has to rotate to stay stable. But it may go even beyond that, to the extent that the form of these craft actually facilitate the function of traveling backward through time through the reorientation of these light cones toward the past.
Wow. And in addition to the light cones and closed time-like curves, the idea of warped time, space-time?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a big part of it. To really understand general relativity, especially since Minkowski space-time was a geometric explanation for space-time. So Einstein's was more kinematic, but Minkowski, who is actually one of Einstein's professors, they sort of bounce stuff back and forth in the development of their ideas. But yeah, since Minkowski's space-time, we can understand these three dimensions of space and one dimension of time in the context of warpages that take place in geometric space. So the most common example is a bowling ball on a sheet, how it makes other balls circling it come toward it because it's warping that sheet. And again, it's impossible to visualize this, because it's four dimensions, but it's essentially the same phenomenon, that it's associated with this warpage that takes place.
Wow. Very, very interesting. Well, Mike, we're about halfway through the show, so I want to take just a quick break. And I do want to invite listeners, if you'd like to call in and ask any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those of you listening live in the chat room, feel free to pose your questions. And then when we come back from break, Mike, a couple of the chapters in your book are devoted to intertemporal interaction. So I'd like to find out what that's all about, okay?
Absolutely.
Great. Okay, everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,400 shows we have had over the past 9 years. Also on the site is a link to the products and services we provide: books, photography, a wellness store, and self-publishing assistance. Our show is a free podcast on iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, iHeartRadio, and TuneIn. And you can subscribe for free on any of those platforms by using the links on our website homepage. We are on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc. And we also have buttons to those platforms at the top of our homepage. Our website, biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today, my very special guest is Dr. Michael P. Masters, and we are talking about his new book, Identified Flying Objects, A Multidisciplinary Scientific Approach to the UFO Phenomenon. Again, you can find out more about Mike by visiting his website, which is idflyobj.com, and that's idflyobj.com. Okay, everyone. So, Mike, before going to break, like I mentioned, you spend a good deal of space in your book about talking about intertemporal interaction. So, can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, sure. The last couple of chapters of the book essentially attempt to try to look at what might happen with this interaction. So it circles back to implications of time travel in the context of potential paradoxes, or what people have perceived as time paradoxes in the past, and explains those in a little more detail to clarify the research that's been done, mostly drawing from what's known as the Novikov self-consistency principle, which essentially states that in returning to the past, that everything remains self-consistent, because anything you did before leaving already exists as part of that past. It's all self-contained. It's all just part of this process of bridging different slices of block time, essentially. So it gets into that a little bit, and then really tries to explain like why they might be doing this, and what's interesting about it, and what was really kind of fun about becoming an anthropologist is I could start to see, in doing archaeological digs and examining our hominin ancestors, their teeth and their bones and their artifacts later on once we had culture, how if I had access to time travel technology, the things I would do to them are almost identical to what's described by people who have experienced these interactions, who have had an abduction encounter, I guess, as they're referred to. So it looks at it kind of a who are they, why are they doing this, what might be some reasons behind it. And again, it's not just speculating about potential reasons for this, but rather looking at things that we do now and trying to for instance, manage the genetics of a population and instances of inbreeding and population declines, and how we manage them in a way that's somewhat akin to what's described in these reports. And again, this shouldn't just be taken as evidence of that we can't just compare them as apples to apples, because there is still the question of whether or not, you know, this can be confirmed. We don't have confirmation of this. But if we can trust these people and they are having these same encounters that are so consistent across these reports, then, you know, we should look at that. And the last couple chapters of the book just attempt to try to tie together these experiences with what we know now about brain-to-brain communication, telepathy, consciousness, even intertemporal interaction in the context of tourism, that some of these encounters may be people from the future who have paid to visit the past so that they can really soak it all in, see what was happening at time periods that they were interested in.
Yeah, I think I saw that Twilight Zone episode.
It's pretty common. It's pretty common in different films and TV shows.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, if you, like you mentioned, from the anthropological perspective of if they were coming back to find out where they came from, so to speak, you know, they're,
yeah.
You know, I could see where, you know, that would be, I could see where that would be a logical possibility, you know.
Yeah,
and
it's research.
That would give
it's
answers.
Just research.
Yeah. So, now, you know, there's a lot of, you know, when it comes to the idea of time travel and interaction from, you know, different periods, that it was like do not interact and affect the timeline kind of aspect. So
right.
What's your idea, you know, of that? I mean, if it were anthropological, if that was their purpose, then obviously it wouldn't be to affect the present, you know, to create a particular future. It would be more, like you said, research. But what if it was to alter the course of that timeline? Or would it? I mean, is that built into the, you know, the past, present, that block time idea that it, you know, it's all existing
yeah.
no matter what?
Exactly, yeah. So if we look at it in the context of general relativity and the block universe, Novikov pointed out that it's not necessarily a situation of cause in the past and effect in the future like we're used to. Our everyday experiences are that way. But you can have something from the future cause an effect in the past, but it doesn't change anything. It doesn't necessarily cause a timeline shift, or as they would view it in quantum mechanics, a shift into a different universe in the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, and that should be considered. You know, we should definitely consider that. But in the context of the block universe, there is the self-consistency. So as Novikov pointed out, the future can actually dictate events in the past, because the future, the present, and the past are all one. None of them are ahead of or behind the other one in the way that we think of it now in the presence of a time machine. So the things, like I said before, it's also non-disruptive, meaning that everything resulting from someone visiting and interacting with the past had already occurred prior to that person ever leaving from the future to visit the past. So there's this inherent self-consistency where you're not disrupting things. It's not causing the shift or this Mandela effect or butterfly effect, but it's always existed as part of this connection between different slices of block time. It maintains self-consistency throughout. And it's interesting to think about, and it's one of the most fun parts of writing the book, is to really get into the way in which time is viewed as biological organisms, and the way it's viewed in the context of physics and even in quantum mechanics. What is happening with what we perceive as this movement from the past to the future, and then what could potentially happen if we move from the future to the past. And yeah, like getting into the physics of that and the perceived time paradoxes, but then as you mentioned, really trying to expand on that in the last couple chapters and in the context of just human interaction and how we would perceive each other and interact with each other. It was a really really exciting part of this research.
Yeah, it would be. So what has been the reaction of some of your peers regarding, you know, the study that you've done so far?
It's actually been really positive. I had a book release, I guess it was a few months now, late March, and I would say at least 40% of the people there were my academic colleagues, my peers, in various fields of science, looking at nanotechnology. I teach at an engineering school, so a lot of them are engineers and material science people, and all of them have been very supportive and excited about the research, and we talk about it at the pub when we're having some beers, and it's been great because everybody can contribute something different. Like I said earlier, I think we need more open discussion about this. And to be honest, I really didn't know what it would be like. I was a little nervous about it and even thought about publishing under a pseudonym for a while. But I realized that a big part of making progress with regard to understanding this phenomenon and with disclosure is going to take people standing up against the stigma and the status quo of dismissal and debunking and skepticism, which are healthy for growing scientific theories, but which are somewhat damaging in this respect. So I've been extremely happy and encouraged to see the positive support among my academic peers.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you know, I believe you indicated in your book that you know, the one of the things that you hope to accomplish with that is to at least initiate the discussion, or at least open up the possibility.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now, where does it go from here? Are you continuing the research? What are your current efforts in this study?
Well, I mean, at this point, I'm still working toward opening discussion or trying to continue this discussion amongst a broader group of people, giving talks and traveling around, and some of them at UFO conferences. I'll be at the MUFON 50th anniversary conference, I think just next week actually, and then the International UFO Congress down in Phoenix in early September. But even beyond that, just giving talks at libraries and bookstores and having things published in various news media outlets, just to try to open up some dialogue about this, or at least to try to further a discussion. We even actually have a TV project in the works to make a docuseries around the book. So a big part of it, I wouldn't even call it promotion necessarily. It's just conversating. It's having this discussion. I mention in the book a lot that we need for this to happen. We need to get past the stigma and talk about these things. So a big part of what I'm doing now is just talking about it and helping to evolve what I've always described as an ever-evolving project.
Yeah. Well, you know, in one sense, you know, I think people who are skeptical about, like you said, how were these ETs going to be able to find us, this little blue dot, you know, amongst the huge galaxy versus time travel? I mean, they, you know, we know where we are, we come back to where we are.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's one of those things where it kind of resolves a few issues, you know, as far as what, you know, skeptics would have as far as, you know, the ETs.
Yeah.
But then again,
and
you have that time aspect. But then you have that time aspect. So what do you hope that readers are going to take away from reading Identified Flying Object?
Well, a big part of it, I hope, is just a better understanding of our current understanding of time. It's as one of the very first quotes by St. Augustine is, and I'm paraphrasing here, but what do we do more? What governs our lives more, but is the least understood aspect of life than time? It's this thing that dictates so much about what we do on a day-to-day basis, but we never talk about it, and we never really think abstractly about it, or even in the context of the physics of time and why eggs always fall off and break and never come back up and reform as eggs on the countertop, that sort of thing. So I think, I hope that a lot of people develop a deeper understanding of time, or at least our current understanding of it, and also learn about anthropology. I, as an anthropologist, naturally talk more about that in the book, not just in the context of our evolutionary changes and morphological shifts, but also sociocultural changes and things that are very important to understanding the relationship between culture and biology, how they've impacted each other over the last 3.3 million years. So I would hope people see those two things, and also just that this phenomenon can be investigated in a very serious way with a very reserved, cautious approach that's still scientific, that still follows all of the standards of scientific research, and is very willing to point out when something is said that doesn't, or that may fall into that category of postulation, or trying to think about how this might turn out based on these long-term past trends. So I hope people just enjoy the multidisciplinary aspect and the cautious approach, essentially.
Yeah, and it's great, because I think, you know, that caution and the wide view, you know, approach is really what's going to be able to, you know, draw people in and at least open up the minds, you know, to possibility. And, you know,
yeah.
Once that happens, you know, then you're making advances at that point. You know, then you know, it's no longer a stigma attached to it. That
right.
It kind of falls into the area of serious study.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an important part, is moving past not just the stigma, but really helping people to see that it's something that should be taken seriously, and there's ways to do it that aren't just crazy people with big hair and tinfoil hats saying whatever they feel like saying and yelling it from the rooftops. We can actually look at this with a scientific approach.
Yeah. Well, you know, and for those who feel that they've had an abduction experience, you know, they can, instead of being a nefarious reason for someone to do what they did, it was for science, you know.
Yeah, and I would hope that's somewhat comforting to people. I mean, I can't imagine going through something like that. I've never even seen a UFO, so I really can't even speak from experience in any capacity. But, yeah, I think, I mean, a lot of these people are truly traumatized by what happened to them. There's so many unanswered questions, and if I'm able to offer an explanation about who these individuals are and why they were doing this, and especially putting in the context of something as understandable as going to the doctor and having them examine you and collect tissues for research and study, I mean, that's something we can get on board with. That's something that we experience now, not usually with time travelers, but it's more or less
right.
The same phenomenon, just with, you know, somebody, a doctor from a different time rather than a different
right.
place.
You can kind of relate to it. So,
it's relatable.
Understandable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Mike, thank you for your time today. I've really enjoyed our discussion. It's a fascinating book, and I love the way that you approach just the whole topic, you know. And it's like I say, it's a fascinating book. So, again, thank you for sharing your time with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It was great talking to you.
It's my pleasure. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Dr. Michael P. Masters. He is the author of Identified Flying Objects, a Multidisciplinary Scientific Approach to the UFO Phenomena. And again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is idflyobj.com. And that's idflyobj.com. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Remember, our show is available as a free podcast from Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. To follow our show, visit our homepage at byteradio.me and select the platform you use most. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at byteradio.me. Until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.